So what I'm doing is I'm making an educational video that follows this character of Susie and the expert. And the expert announces to Susie, basically, the world is going to be underwater in a year, and you have to learn how to swim, and you have to find a friend to teach you. So you're going to learn how to make a friend. You're going to learn how to swim. And that was born out of the fact that, like, I'm learning how to swim very late in life. And it's, again, it's very hard to learn things late in life, especially with my background, right? The abuse background and everything. So what this expert guides Susie through is how to make a friend. And one of the things in making a friend is vetting a friend, right? So is this the right friend for you? Is this somebody you can trust? And I feel like I have a much higher standard for a friend than the average person. And I put a lot more importance on friendship than the average person. Because I don't have that family, it's like I've always wanted a friend that feels like a family, right? The friends that you see on TV that like hang out often and all that, which is not realistic, which is not reality, especially for people around my age range. It's like people kind of disappear into their little enclaves, into their little family units. And the priority is always your blood family and then romance and then friendship.
There's like a deeper meaning behind all of this. Like it's how you were raised, what you were taught, what you were conditioned to believe.
This is the Desi Condition.
Hello, hello. What's up, Bondhus? This is the Desi Condition. I'm your host, Anushri. Anu is here with us today.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Anu. I hope you're not tired of hearing me.
No, what? You have the best voice ever. So our guest today is Saimin Adif. She is a New York City and Norway-based artist, freelance art director, comedian, and writer. I found her through a really beautiful piece that she wrote for the Bengalis of New York. It was called I Never Loved My Parents, and it just really struck me. So she is Bangladeshi born, US raised. So now you're in Norway. So Saimin, I have a lot of questions for you. Can you start with who you are? How did you come to be? That sounded more, I think, existential than I meant for it to sound. But you may answer it in that manner if you would like to. And just talk to us about, like, what are you doing right now?
Hi, I'm Saimin. This is, I think, the first podcast I've ever done. So quite an honor for you guys.
That's awesome.
Yay.
I would say, you know, I was born in Bangladesh. My spiritual self. No, I'm kidding. my origins. What was the question? I've already messed up. I've already forgot everything.
You're doing great. You're just as distracted as the rest of us get. Okay, my question was, who are you? What are you doing? What's good in the world of Saimin? Right.
Okay, who am I? What am I doing? So like you said, I'm like a multi-hyphenate. I have way too many hobbies. I do a lot of shit. And I found myself in Norway because I was sick of America. And after living in New York for, I think, 12 years plus, I was ready to go. And to move to Europe, you either have to get a job or go to school or find that sweet green card marriage. And I chose school. And it's free here if you want like a master's of fine art taught in English. There were literally 5 choices and 4 were in Norway. Although now they've passed a law where it's no longer free for people outside the EU. Mm-hmm. So that sucks. But for me, I got it. It's free. And yeah, I'm back in like student housing after living on my own for like 10 years. So it's quite strange. I'm like 35. I'm around a lot of people in their 20s. So that's been interesting. But yeah, I'm just here to basically focus more on the art side of things. I'm working towards a short film and accompanying project that's going to be out in a year. We can talk about that. And other than that, I'm just like trying to enjoy life, man.
Okay, so you are in Norway. You were studying, you were getting an MFA, you said.
Mm-hmm.
What is the end goal with that?
The end goal is just to live in Europe. I mean, there's no end goal other than I want to graduate and either get a job, preferably in Spain. If I don't get a job in Spain, then Norway is my first choice. Because obviously, you know, the government cares about its people here for the most part. They have all these wonderful social programs. It's safe here. I can walk down the street and not have to be like worrying about my safety and not have random dudes talking to me. You know, that's pretty sweet. It's pretty valuable to me at this point in my life.
Yeah, walking around at night, that sounds like a utopia.
I mean, no, there's fucked up things there for sure. But like, it's such like a small percentage compared to New York and compared to America that I'm like, all right, you take what you can get. This world sucks.
I would love to just learn a bit more about your experiences in the US and just what it was like as a creative for you here versus in Norway. Has there been a difference?
Well, we moved to the US in 1996. I was 8 years old. We moved to Arkadelphia, Arkansas, which is a small town. So that was fun. Basically, you know, like I've wrote this, I touched on it a little bit in my article where like between like the bigoted town and my bigoted parents, it was very isolating to be there. And it was isolating to not share those beliefs, to not be religious, to be a quite little weirdo immigrant child where people, you know, I'm also like ethnically ambiguous. Bengalis come up to me all the time, like, you're from Bangladesh? Like, I was literally in a class where they were going around saying what languages we speak. And, you know, I said Bangla, I said English, Spanish, whatever. And this guy comes up to me and he was like, how do you know Bangla? You know? And I was just like, well, I didn't just go out of my way to learn Bangla. Why would I learn? Nobody does that. I'm sorry. I was like,
nobody ever thinks I'm Bengali. Nobody ever thinks I'm Bengali.
No. As a hobby, are you kidding? Nobody would ever choose. Okay, so.
Yeah.
Oh, there was also a wonderful incident once where I went into, I don't know, like a pawn shop or something. And the guy asked me where I was from. And he was from Bangladesh. And I said, I'm from Bangladesh. And he goes like, no, but you're beautiful. That was probably my favorite.
Oh my God.
No.
Because it's like, oh, okay, so Bengalis are ugly. Like, I think people just assume I'm Latina. So, anyways, I had a lot of interesting bullying in Arkansas. There was one guy, I remember he chased me around in recess and he was throwing like every slur in the book because he couldn't figure it out. So that's like, you know, that's the trials and tribulations of being ethnically ambiguous. And then the question is, like, is a difference? Oh, and then from there, it was like Texas, Virginia. I went to UVA. And then I moved to New York in 2010. I thought I was going to be a fashion designer. So I went to FIT for this one-year program they have after you graduate from university. So I'm like a month in, I was like, oh, I don't want to be a fashion designer, actually. I just love couture. And I don't want any part of this business. But UVA was free for me for being like smart and poor, but then I paid for FIT, you know, out of my own savings from working since I was 16. So I felt like I had to follow through. So I was a fashion designer for about a year and a half. My last job was for Calvin Klein soft accessories, you know, scarves, hats. Mm-hmm. And then from that, I switched to graphic design. And then I worked my way up to art direction. And I also did like illustration and coding and pretty much anything an ad agency would do, I would do. And I taught myself how to code when I was like 11. I went to a website like Lisa Explains It All that's for children to learn how to code. And I made like my first website. I used to like do those little dolls. I don't know if you guys remember, but like there was a point where these little dolls were very popular on the internet and you would just draw like different outfits on them. You put it on your website or whatever. But I did that shit. I was super into it. I wasn't allowed to go anywhere. So I was like indoor kid watching TV all the time, on the fucking computer all the time. And that's what I did. But that came in handy because, like, I got a graphic design job with, like, zero experience in graphic design. Like, I could just, like, churn it out. And because I was like, well, I've been doing this as a fucking child. So it's, like, very easy for me. And I never had to get that official professional education in it. And I've been doing that. So basically since I was like 22, 23 professionally, like 23 professionally. And in terms of what's the difference between Norway doing creative things in Norway versus New York, I feel like there's a lot of low key, like racism in New York at least with the comedy scene that I noticed, that like, it's just like a lot of white people with a lot of white friends, and they like, if they like a person of color, they're like, it's like a certain type of person of color, and like someone that's like very adjacent to white or so far from white that they are just like, oh, you know, what an interesting picture. So it's like, if you're neither of those things, that's kind of like, oh, we don't know what to make of you. You're kind of like harsh in the way you speak, you know, like I'm very direct. Like it's stuff like that where I just kept like feeling the friction and the tension. And here, I feel like I've barely noticed any racism, like maybe a couple of incidences. And I've been here since August. So, which is like crazy because, you know, in New York, I notice it all the time.
That's really cool. Do you think that that's made a direct impact on some of your creative works as you've been in Norway? Do you feel like you have a little bit more agency?
I just feel like there's less barriers in a way, and there's more support from, like, it's such a small group here. Like, the program I got accepted to, it's only 20 people. And then your teachers you see all the time, and you can get so, you know, almost like, I feel like close is the wrong word, but like you can get close to them in a way that you can't in a bigger program, you know?
It's more intimate.
Yeah. So like, and they know you more, you know? So that's interesting. I've enjoyed that. That aspect of it is just getting to know people.
When did you know that you wanted to pursue art? When was that like a realization for you?
I had an internship at the State Department when I went to UVA, like around like 2007. And like the internship, I feel like could have been cool, but like somebody fucked up something where they weren't prepared for me to come into the department that I was supposed to be in, which was like the language affairs department. And they stuck me in grants and it was a lot of bullshit, a lot of meetings. And I just saw these people just miserable, just going to meetings all the time. I'm like, when I went to UVA, UVA is known, you know, it's Thomas Jefferson's university. They have a really good law school. It turns out like business people, like finance bros and lawyers. So I thought I was going to be a corporate attorney because I looked at a book of starting salaries when I was like 11 or 12, and a corporate attorney's starting salary was 90 grand. So that's why I was at UVA. And after that State Department internship, I was just like, fuck this. I should just, I was already art studio, art history double major. Like it's already art related. I'm just like, I should just pursue graphic design or fashion design. And I chose Ron. I chose fashion design. But whatever, you know, course corrected. I just knew I had to get to New York. I did get into NYU, but I needed like a full scholarship. And they only gave me like 27 grand out of 44. So that wasn't going to work for me.
How'd you get into comedy?
Comedy, I've always been obsessed with. Basically, you know, when I was a kid, I would really only be myself around like three people, you know, like it was like my best friend, my Indian best friend. Like we were the two South Asians in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. And I saw her and I was immediately like, be my friend. And so her, my sister and my mother, My sister and my mother have seen my like true self. Like, it's just, even though I don't speak to either of them now, but like, it, like I'm like a humongous goofball. I'm always doing bits, like, especially when I was younger, I was always just doing like fucking voices and, you know, faces and just like always just being annoying. And like, and in school, I was just like a mute. But I was obsessed with Conan O'Brien. You know, I like watch his late night show every single night. I was obsessed with like Strangers with Candy, like all these shows. I felt like really affected me, like all the absurd shows. And then I watched like anything with people of color. So like any show, and that was just black people at the time, you know, like they only allowed, if they allowed a person of color, it was just black people at the time. So I watched every show with any black person. So I, you know, any funny show at the time, like all the sister, the fucking, God, everything's escaping me now. But like, all those shows that would come on Fridays on UPN, I watched. And in terms of when I started pursuing comedy, it was like my late 20s. And I just got to a point where I was working in New York as an art director, designer, whatever. And I was freelancing and I suddenly had time to pursue my other interests. I went from the 9 to 5 to make my own hours or only 3 days a week. And I suddenly had free time. And I'm like, what am I doing here in New York and not pursuing the things I actually want to do? So it just made zero sense to not actually try. And so I took a UCB class. It was like Improv 101. And then I applied to their diversity scholarship. And I said to myself, well, if I don't get the scholarship, I'm not going to bother paying hundreds of fucking dollars for these classes. You know, but then I did, I got it like a few times and then I got maybe 9, 10 free classes out of it. And they're all like $400 a class or something like that. So it was like a great deal. I learned so much just through that. And yeah. And then I got on, they do like a blind, audition to be a writer for a sketch team. So you just like submit without your name. And I got into that. And then a few months after I got into that, like, then the pandemic started and the theater closed. So I was like the last UCB house team. I think we might have been the last or second to last show ever at the UCB in Chelsea before it closed down. So I'm always getting in just under the wire before things collapse.
Unrelated, what is your zodiac sign?
Oh, are you guys God. Like astrology hoes? What's going on?
No, I am. What is it though?
What do you think it is?
You're giving me like Aquarius or Gemini vibes. I'm getting really strong like air sign energy. And if you're not an air sign, then you're probably a fire sign. Maybe Sagittarius. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. What are you?
You're so wrong. It's funny.
I'm Capricorn. What is it? What is it?
Capricorn.
Okay. I was so off.
Why?
I was
no.
so off. Here's the thing. Anytime I'm reserved, because I can be very, I'm very introverted and I can be very reserved when I'm bored or I don't like somebody or whatever. And then when they can guess Capricorn in those moments, they always guess Capricorn correctly. But when I'm just like, la, 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 nobody ever guesses right.
So. But do you know like your rising or your moon
no.
at all? Like, do you know?
No,
any
I tried
of that?
To
okay.
ask my mother, like, what time was I born? She doesn't know. I don't know.
Well, you know your location. We can talk about this after. We don't have to do this in the episode, but I'm just like, I'm curious. Anyway, let's keep going.
You can look it up for me and tell me.
I will. Believe me.
She 100%
will.
And she will tell you everything about okay. you, and you will never know how she knew.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Can you tell me my future? Do you do tarot?
No,
not a fortune teller.
I don't do tarot. I do natal chart readings though, so I can give you like a full breakdown of like just like your. It's I see it as like a self development tool. It's like it's like a deeper way to like understand yourself through astrology. It's just like another like medium. Mm-hmm. So I don't do predictive astrology. I'm not at that point yet, but hopefully one day I will be. Mm-hmm. But I was very curious. I'm a Capricorn rising.
Okay.
But you're not giving me any Capricorn energy. Like, you're giving me, like, I feel like you probably have like air or like fire sign rising.
Well, okay. I don't know if this helps you. It probably does. Fuck. Like I'm on a cusp. I'm January 19th.
Oh, so you do have like your Aquarius and Capricorn. Like, yeah, you're basically like on the cusp of it.
Wow.
Yeah. Did you guess Aquarius?
You're giving me straight up. Yeah, you're giving me straight up like Aquarius vibes.
What are those vibes? Yeah. Tell me.
Just like what a Capricorn very, like. Capricorn is like, are we really doing this? Like,
we'll just hijack the episode with astrology. Like, it's fine.
Because I could go on. I just didn't want, I wanted to stick to the script, you know? But Capricorn is like very boss energy. Yeah. Like you're here to build a legacy.
Like organized.
Very much about like,
yeah.
I wouldn't even say that, but like very like ambitious. Like you have goals. Your goals, like you're very like motivated. You want to build things. Like you want to leave like an impact on this world. And like Capricorn and Aquarius are similar in that way. Like you both want to leave some sort of an impact on the world. But I think Aquarius is more detached about it, and they're more like humanitarians than anything. They're thinking about like the collective, and Capricorn is kind of like, well, what can I like build like for myself, kind of, that can like make me get to like where I need to get to. So the energies are like very different, but they kind of have like similar big goals. Okay. Yeah, but I can tell you
are
more
Aquarius like, more fun Capricorns.
Yeah, well, not? You know what, kind of in a way. In a way.
Oh no, we've just lost our Capricorn listeners.
Capricorn is you know what? I will not take this
shame of Capricorns. I'm standing up for you guys.
Somebody's gotta. Anu hates them, apparently.
I don't hate them. I'm kidding. I'm a rising, man. I have it inside of me too. I have Capricorn inside of me too. But it's rising. Yeah, I was just curious. Rising is your like it's like the first impression that people have of you. So
I see.
Okay. So you're yeah. So that's why I was like, what is she?
Aquarius rising.
you might be. You might be an Aquarius rising. Yes. I would be really shocked if you were also a Capricorn rising. Yeah. I'd be super shocked.
You just have to catch me in a bad mood. I'll give you Capricorn. Okay, we can move
anyway.
On.
Moving forward,
we gotta move on.
Let's talk about crystals. I'm just kidding.
I know zero about that. Either. Zero.
I know Myers-Briggs, sort of.
Yeah.
I'm virtuoso.
I'm an ENFP, I think.
Okay, we gotta get back on topic, guys.
Yeah.
We cannot hijack the episode with our various personality tests, and we gotta keep it moving. But I love that you started talking about comedy. What is the form that your comedy is taking in this moment in your life?
I do only sketch comedy, and I also write headlines for The Onion, and that's it. Mm. And I guess while I'm here in Norway, I said I'm making that short film. Like my whole objective now is to combine hurt and humor. I told Anu this. Basically, you know, it's crazy that I've never combined art that I was doing and the comedy that I was doing. Like, oh, art's, you know, art had the serious stuff. Comedy, you know, I guess had some serious stuff.
Well, I think until maybe you got to Notes for This Utopia.
Yeah, so
that was funny.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Like, when did I officially start including anything funny in my art? I guess it is Notes for This Utopia. That's the series that I made. It's like a series of 9 videos. And this series purports to end every issue ever in the Desi community. And also maybe your community, you know, I don't know. Like if you watch it, it'll possibly fix the world. I don't know, you know, so it's just like tackles like different things. I think any self-respecting, critical thinking Desi would think about our community. Like the one that really resonated, I feel like, is the one that says, what would people say? And I made these like little sculptures, and they're kind of like, and I made them out of clay because I wanted something earthy, that it felt ancient, that was like finicky, the way people are and imperfect. And then I put these clay little figures and I animated them against a very bright background. And like I used my graphic design background and made it very graphic. So it like stops you in your track because I knew I was going to post it on Instagram. So like the one, what would people say? I made basically a sculpture based off my father. Okay. Hashtag father issues. Hashtag also have mother issues. But I made this one of my father. And it's basically a Desi man with his like arms on his hip and his head going every which way. And the caption is something like, when you've looked every fucking where but inward. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that describes so many Desi people where they're looking at everybody's opinion. They're not doing any soul searching. It's just about keeping face, you know, having a good reputation, you know, watching yourself and being the, you know, prototypical Desi perfect person, whatever that means to them. And this one, I played all of these in New York in this show that I had at QED. And we all kind of talked about it afterwards. Like people put in their own complaints on notes. So we talked about that. And I also just asked them like, what resonated with you? And that one was one where like, yeah, what would people say? Like fucking Desi people are obsessed with what would people say. It's so important. It's more important than anything. More important than your child's happiness, more important than your happiness, more important than being mentally well, like anything.
What were some of the reactions that you got from that piece that were kind of like eye-opening or at least even affirming?
I think a lot of it was affirming because it was just like people being like, yes, yes, and that, you know, I think it's just the crowd that came. Like I'm sure in another Desi crowd, people would be like, fuck you. Like, how dare you? Like, you know. But this was just like a very nice crowd in Queens where I think it was like cathartic for a lot of people to get these things off their chest and to talk about their family issues and their specific problems and have it relate to other people and for them to hear somebody else just like so openly talking about these things. It's also like when I wrote that article, you see so many comments like basically like, yes, 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 this is me. I'm so glad somebody said this, blah, blah, blah. Like it's the reaction you'd expect because it's so needed and so necessary for people to just fucking say this shit out loud. Like let's call a spade and just acknowledge reality. And you really can't get that from a lot of people, not just Desi's, but just in general. It's infuriating. And when you're around such an infuriating attitude, it's nice to just hear people speak plainly and speak the truth.
Let's take a quick break from our episode. If you've listened this far, that means you probably like what you're listening to. So why not leave us a rating or a review, hopefully something nice, on Spotify or Apple Podcasts? And tell all your friends about the show, because you probably don't know this, but the Desi Condition is 100% run by people who do this as a side hobby. I myself, the founder, am a high school math teacher and a graduate student, and everyone involved either goes to school or works full time. All of this to say that TDC thrives on word of mouth only and doesn't make any money. And we're not trying to make money. We just want to spread the good word about mental health and wellness. So please take a moment to text your friends about this podcast or leave a rating to support the show. Let's go back to our regular content.
You are very comfortable with discomfort.
Yeah.
You wrote that piece.
That's
about
my brand. Thank you so much
parents.
For noticing.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we can talk about that piece, have you always been like that?
It's hard to say because it's like, I feel like, you know, I was a different person before, moving to America. Like, I lived in Bangladesh till I was 8 and, you know, shitty things happened in Bangladesh. But like my parents were distracted by their lives that they had there, you know, like my family, I think generations ago on my father's side, they did accumulate some wealth, and then every generation after squandered it. And when we were in Bangladesh, we were in a big house. We had a lot of servants. I think my dad had some job where that's not like a real job, that kind of thing, like kind of a nepotism job. And, you know, he had things going on. And then once we moved to Arkadelphia, Arkansas, both of my parents worked really shit jobs. We were like low income. I was getting free meals at school. Like my father, I think, he got my mother this job working at basically a sweatshop, like a mini sweatshop, without her knowing. And then they both eventually worked at the Walmart, and then Walmart Supercenter when it became a supercenter. My father was quite miserable, you know, he's had a lot of failures. And I was the youngest. My oldest brother is like 14 years older than me. The other one's 12 years older. My sister is 7 years older. So I was just like the 8-year-old at home, who was like the easiest person to pick on, I think. And my father really went in. And that really changed me. I mean, he beat the shit out of me in Bangladesh. I don't know. I feel like I barely registered him. Like, he would come into a room, I would leave the room. And that continued in America as well. But like, he had a lot of time to fixate on me when we were in America. And the way I realized, like, my little kid brain was like, oh, how do I cope with this? I noticed he yelled less if I didn't give any reaction. Like, if I was just like stone-faced, said nothing, endured, then I would go out to my room and I cry, you know? But like, if I was like stone face, like, it would end quicker, like the abuse. So, and that kind of went into school as well. It's like, I was the immigrant kid, and, you know, it was jarring being around all these. It was white people, there was black people, there was my one Indian friend, there was like one Mexican, one Asian. It was just jarring. Like, you know, going from Bangladesh, where, you know, it's just Bangladeshis, to this, and seeing the class divide, the racial divide, whatever. So like, all of that stuff is how I became obsessed with hierarchies, is like that move when I was 8 years old. I noticed in Bangladesh, like, so basically outside of our little compound, there's this gated compound, there was a house, there was a huge field with a bunch of snakes and garden snakes. And then there was like the servants or whatever. And then the gatehouse. And then outside of that is like literally a street that's so narrow. Maybe, I don't even know, like 5 foot wide and a bunch of vendors. You see like an old man peeing on the street, a little boy peeing on the street. And you have all the vendors selling all the shit. So I saw like the divide in economically, but then when I went to Arkansas, you see all the other divides. And so my point was, my instinct became to just like shut down completely, like completely remove all personality. And my way of coping with the shit at home was to become like a mute, non-emoting person. And then I carried that over to school, mute, non-emoting. And then that made me an easier target for bullies, because it's like, oh, she's not saying anything back. So, you know, they don't even have to try hard. And like, literally the day I started speaking my mind and saying something back, suddenly there was no bullying, you know? Like, it's just, it was just like an easy target. I like made myself an easy target just by not saying anything. So like, because I was like containing myself so much, I can't say that like I've been this way forever, even though I kind of have, but like I was very, I just controlled it and suppressed it. And soon, like I think around like high school and college, I just started giving less and less of a fuck. And that made me more outgoing as just a side effect. And then in college, I fully made a conscious decision to push myself to talk to people, because I was like, I am never getting a job being this quiet. I'm never getting a date being this quiet. So it was just like, I pushed myself to just talk to people until it became natural. And then somewhere along the way, I just became this person that's just, I just say what I want to say. And I have had to like hold back whatever, but I've realized that like, it just got to a point where I realized whether I held my personality back, whether I was fully myself, I always encountered somebody that had an issue with me. So I'm like, now I'm like, whatever. Now I'm just like fully myself. I'm like, who cares? There's either way, there's going to be somebody with an issue. There's somebody like who's going to read into or project or whatever. So very free and loose these days. Another thing I helped, this is a very long answer, but this is very, but you know, what are you going to do? Another thing is like around my mid 20s, around like 24, I started saying what my childhood was actually like for the first time. Because I'd always held that in and always been very composed on the outside. And I couldn't be composed anymore because I got this autoimmune disease called Graves' disease. And it's a fully like physical thing. And I got it around, I think I had it for maybe 5 years undiagnosed, like from 20. It basically, your thyroid function is are overactive and everything is just hyperactive, like your metabolism's very high. Your hands are shaking all the time. Your eyes are kind of bulging. Like everything's like just like too much of everything. And it kind of mimics the feeling of anxiety and depression, things I don't normally have. But because like I was opening up for the first time and I had this Graves' disease, I was like crying a lot in public and I was like losing that control. So I didn't know what was happening. I could tell there was something wrong with my body, but I was like, oh, is this also me opening up? So once like I was cured, I was back to like, you know, composed, I mean. But I was like way more open to just my emotions and way more honest with my emotions after that whole period. I felt like I spent many years just not being honest with myself, which is a lot of people aren't honest with themselves. But and also they're like afraid of being vulnerable, they're afraid of crying. And after all that, it's just like after like crying at like so many bars at Penn Station, like everywhere on the subway multiple times, it's just like I have no shame about crying anymore. Like I just don't give a shit. I've cried in front of people as I did like various professional obligations around my art and comedy. Like it's just I just don't care anymore. I guess that's a summation. Once I cared, now I don't.
I feel like you got to your 30s like way before any of us did. So you know when like, you hit 30 and you're just like,
I was like a little adult, which is what happens when you're abused as a child and you're neglected emotionally. You become like a little adult, you become hyper independent. And then I basically just had to teach myself how to be a normal emotional human being. And now I'm here.
Can you tell us a bit about how like your mental health challenges, physical challenges, and your experience, your childhood experiences have shaped some of your creative work? And we could specifically talk about I Never Loved My Parents now. Or I think even in general, like how has it impacted you as an artist?
Yeah, so I Never Loved My Parents, I talked about this feeling I've always had, I still have, of being an outlier. Because, you know, because I never loved my parents, quote, you know, naming the title of the article. But because of that, it's like I didn't take what they said as gospel, the way kids do, kids who are even abused. Like I saw their mistreatment of me and I thought, hey, this is not a good person. And when they would say, spout their beliefs, you know, their very religious beliefs, their very bigoted beliefs against Black people, Hispanic people, gay people, you know, et cetera, against me. You know, they would love to call me, you know, dumb, useless, ungrateful, all these fun things. And it's just like, I knew not to believe them. And I knew not to believe pretty much anything anybody told me. So like, I never believed in God.
How did you know?
I never believed in, you know, like any fairy tales. I don't, you know, I was too old to believe in Santa by the time I got there, but like anything. Any of it, but everything
how
I questioned.
How did you know and, not to believe the stuff that your parents said?
I feel like there's always a period of time for every kid where there is at least a short amount of time where they do believe, and then they eventually like get to the point where they like really process what their parents are saying, and they're like, wait, hold on, I have to question this. So I guess like I'm wondering, like, was there ever that period for you, or you just like you came out of the womb like knowing that this shit didn't make sense?
There never was. And that's why it's so fucking weird. There just never was. Uh-huh. Because like, they were always so shitty from as long as I could remember. And I could just see how many mistakes they made. And I felt like maybe I'm just like, I was too logical, too rationally minded. But I was like, a lot of things just didn't make sense. When I was 9 years old, my mother was discussing, I don't know, the Quran or something. And she was talking about how as girls, as women, we have to cover up so as not to tempt men. And I literally said to her as a 9 year old, I was like, how does that make sense? You know, like, how is that on us? And so that's what I'm saying. Like, I always like push back. And that's probably why they abused me even more, honestly. Because it's just like, that's why I also stopped saying shit. I'll just keep it to myself. But it's, I think they saw the rebellious nature, even though I was like fucking straight A student, never doing anything. But like that kind of rebellious mind was enough of a threat to push down. But with the God thing, it's just like, you know, I'm agnostic. So I'm like, maybe there is a God, maybe there's something, I don't care. But like, it's just, we're never going to know. And it's not important to me. But as a child, I just remember, like, they made me read the Quran. And there would be parts, like, very early on, it was just like, oh, you know, periods are disgusting, basically, blah, blah, blah. You know, all these rules about periods. And I was like, okay, well, if God, this dude up in the sky, made women and made periods, why would he think it's disgusting? You know, it's just like, there's just no logic to it. And I would just read, you know, like different types of fairy tales and stories. And I would just wonder, how is this any different? And I don't know. I've always had that fucking rebellious spirit. Like, even if I didn't express it, like, I've always had that questioning spirit.
I think what you're saying just describes why the title of that piece and that sentiment came about. If you don't believe anything a person is saying, you don't feel safety with them. So how could you love them?
Right. And that's the thing, is like, I never trusted them.
Yeah.
Right. So I never trusted them. So I never trusted what they said. And I never had a feeling of comfort, safety, security, any of it.
I think it's good to feel like that. I think that sentence in itself is so sensational. I think like this is why I was drawn to it, but not because I'm thinking that this is a bad thing. It's because it's a different it's a different view, and it's, you know, if your parents are not people that make you feel safe, you should feel like that. It's so looked down on
and
to feel like that.
What I had a hard time with is the fact that I would meet other people with abusive parents, and they were always the type that still wanted their parents' love and approval. And so that's why I couldn't relate. I was like, I can't relate to the people with normal parents or good parents. And I can't relate to the people with abusive parents. And that was extremely isolating for me. Like, I still have yet to meet anybody in person that had the same thing. You know, I've had messages from the article of people with similar, but like in person, I've never met that type of person. And I can segue this to the project I'm working on for my master's, how to make friends in the water, because it's basically born out of the fact that like, if you grow up in this kind of environment, it's hard to learn how to connect with people. It's hard. You have to teach yourself, you know, and it's like, you know, where do you get the tools? Like, there's all these educational videos in 1940s, 50s, 60s America, where they're like in black and white, and it's like how to basically be a human, how to be trustworthy, how to make friends. These educational videos from the 40s and on, like they basically teach you how to be human. So what I'm doing is I'm making an educational video that follows this character of Susie and the expert. And the expert announces to Susie, basically, the world is going to be underwater in a year, and you have to learn how to swim, and you have to find a friend to teach you. So you're going to learn how to make a friend. You're going to learn how to swim. And that was born out of the fact that, like, I'm learning how to swim very late in life. And it's, again, it's very hard to learn things late in life, especially with my background, right? The abuse background and everything. So what this expert guides Susie through is how to make a friend. And one of the things in making a friend is vetting a friend, right? So is this the right friend for you? Is this somebody you can trust? And I feel like I have a much higher standard for a friend than the average person. And I put a lot more importance on friendship than the average person. Because I don't have that family, it's like I've always wanted a friend that feels like a family, right? The friends that you see on TV that like hang out often and all that, which is not realistic, which is not reality, especially for people around my age range. It's like people kind of disappear into their little enclaves, into their little family units. And the priority is always your blood family and then romance and then friendship. And people's ideas of friendship is just so wide ranging. It could be like, oh, we're best friends. We see each other every 3 years. We barely speak. That's my best friend. Or it could be just somebody you do activities with. That's my friend. You know, like it could mean anything. But for me, for a friend, like I need somebody who I can actually rely on in the tougher moments. And that is very difficult to find. And a friendship that there's like a depth of connection. Because otherwise, I feel like it is just a sea of acquaintances. And that doesn't do anything for me.
I have a question. I don't think this question matters. I think it's just like a morbid curiosity that I have. But see, you don't talk to your parents, it sounds like. Okay. Do you think that they loved you?
I think in their own way, you know, I think they definitely think that they love me for sure. For sure. And I just feel like they're limited in who they are. And it's like, I wrote in the article, it's like, I know they've been through their own shit. Like, I know my father had an abusive father. I know my mother, you know, was married off to my father when she was like 15 or 16 and he was 30. I think she was 15. And I know she has dark stories from his family, dealing with his family. And then like, I have one cool story. It's like my grandmother on my mother's side, she had a husband that beat her. And she actually divorced him and married her lawyer and then had, you know, my mother and her siblings. And this is a woman in a village in fucking Bangladesh. And she did this shit. Like, this is
what was that, like the 40s? That's incredible.
Exactly. So it's like, when I knew her, she was like...
Well, now we know where you get your radicalness from. This,
she was like, what? I know, exactly. It skipped a generation. It skipped my mother and my sister. It went to me, unfortunately. But like, I know they have generations of bullshit that they have soaked in. And I bet they love their parents. You know what I mean? Like, they soak that shit in. Like, this is the norm. And they're never going to change. And they know what they know. And it's a very limited field that they know. And within what they know, I'm sure, you know, they have love for me. And it's like, you know, my mother, you know, I gave her a chance because... I felt like, you know, my father was like really brutal. She was more like normal shitty, you know, like normal shitty parent. And but she always defended him. She always defended him. And she never, like, there was one point where I was like, I'm not talking to you. And this is why. And then she came back around. She's like, okay, yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. You know, your dad and his family treated me awful, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. But then days later, a week later, she went back to the company script. And she was like, oh, you know, just forget. Both of them love to tell me, just forget it. Just be normal. And, you know, I can't deal with people like that. Like, it's just, and I know my father's not, I feel like he's even more limited than her. And I don't even know if he understands what he did was wrong. I don't know if he sees it that way. And I feel like to him, I'm just like this whiny girl, like, who's just like, oh, maybe too soft or who knows. But, and then my siblings, they really didn't get this, like, the similar type of abuse that I got, because, like, it was such a weird situation of, because they grew up most of their teenage life in Bangladesh, right? And they didn't have to see, they could, like, the brother especially, they could live their life. Like, they got shit, but it wasn't as much as, like, me as, like, a fucking 8-year-old in Arkansas getting the barrage of shit from my father, who's, like, clearly just miserable with his life. You know, like, it's just not the same. And I feel like they're all still in contact because they just, like, okay, they're like, yeah, it's shit, but it's normal, you know? Like, we're just going to stick with it. We're a family, you know? Like, that's their thing. And they're like, we love each other. Like, and to me, it's just all such bullshit. And I feel like if you, like, actually love somebody, you care about somebody's well-being. You care about, you're there for them emotionally. And I feel like it's just something they're not capable of. They can't even do it for themselves. They're not going to do it for me. It's not going to change. And I have no idea if they saw that article or any of the shit I make. I don't care. Like, I feel like the thing they would be annoyed by the most is if somebody they knew could connect the dots and be like, oh, look at your weird ass daughter, you know, like.
What was like the emotional impact on you cutting out your family members?
I mean, it's just tough to know that you don't have a safety net in life, like at all. And whenever I have like a health issue or something, and I'm just like, it's just a depressing thought that it's just like, it is just on you. And, you know, it's like, yeah, like I have money saved. But it just sucks to, like, I've had to be responsible my whole life. There's no moment where I thought I was, like, invincible and just, like, la, 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 living life. It's just, like, I always have to be together because I'm the only one taking care of me. And there's, you know, I was, like, oh, something bad happened. I'll just go to my parents. And then you can't do shit like that. And so there's just, like, nothing holding you up besides yourself. So it's like you just have to be extra, extra responsible. And you never know, like anything can happen. And it's just like a scary thought that like you are alone in this world.
Unless you make enough friends.
Right. I know. And the right friends.
Yeah.
Watch my video, How to Make Friends in the Water. that'll be in a year. In a year. And then the other part of that is like, maybe you guys can join me in a brainstorming session, but like, so I made a deal with this place where I am in Norway, very large swimming institution. It's like beautiful. It's huge. I'm going to film there and I'm also going to have a show there. So it's going to be a screening of the movie. And then I'm going to have all these interactive elements that people are going to come and interact with in the pool, in the water. And they're all going to be about basically questioning how your approach to platonic connection. So like one of the ideas is all these imperfect friends. It's all these sculptures that are going to be floating in the pool. And they're going to look one way up top. And then you kind of have to like dive a little deeper to find out what's wrong with them. Or maybe it's a little obvious up top, but you don't fully know until you like go under and you can just read it. That's going to be one thing. There's going to be one where that's going to be how your social circle changes as you age, how that looks like and kind of represented with like all these rings in the water. And
love that.
Yeah. And then, I don't know, I'm very open. I had one idea that was like, you know, you have all the steps to go to the diving board. And as you go to the board, it's like different things. Like, oh, this person believes in mermaids. Do you go up more step? Do you go down one more step? This person is this. So it's like, and before you take that dive. So, but that's, I don't know. I'm just like thinking of ideas where, like, I also wanted to do one where two people had to put in like equal effort to make anything happen. Like, so it's,
I love that.
So it's a process, you know, I have a year to make this happen, but yeah, I just want people to get, like, think about this shit more.
So we have to start wrapping this up. Is there anything that we didn't talk to you about that you would like to talk about? Your first time on a podcast.
In the pandemic, I made this basically solo character special. It's called Art Thou an Artiste? Yes, I arted. And it's basically me as a host introducing a bunch of different artists who are just me in different wigs. And I would highly recommend. I made it like in between work and I did everything in like 2 months and I filmed it on my phone. So it's kind of rinky dinky, but I think it's really good. Even with the rinky dinky phone quality and all my, I spent $0. I bought and returned so many things to Amazon. I did keep some wigs. Important. And then I got the city artist grant for it and I showed it at a few places around New York. I would recommend that. Or go to SimeenAdive.com, SimeenAdive.com. Or Instagram at SIGHMEAN, which is how I've, it's basically, I don't know, like, what's it called? A catchphrase? I tell people, oh, it's the word sigh. It's the word mean. Sigh mean. And I've said this a million times in my life. Totally not sick of it. Just kidding. I really am. But now it's my Instagram handle. It's my brand now.
I'm putting that all of that in our episode description. Anywhere else that we should look for you? Anything else we should look out for you?
You can find me outside because I hate social media.
All right, walking around Norway. Post, yes.
I try to post, but I'm like, ugh, so. Ugh. But anyways, if I wasn't an artist or a comedian, I would never be on the internet. But I feel like you need people to see your shit. So.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Question before we wrap up: what is the impact that you hope to leave with your work?
I just hope my work gets people to be more honest and say what it is they want to say and be more honest with themselves, be more honest with their families, and just care more about like actual shit and less of the surface shit and get off your screen. I don't know. Like I did this thing once, like I got invited to like an Desi influencer thing. And I was like, I have 500 people following me at this point or 400. I was like, how did I get here? Cause there would be somebody that has like 100,000 followers. And everybody was talking about like the anxiety they have about like being a presence on the internet and like all this shit. So like, I just encourage people to make things just to make things, not to be seen, just for fun. I think that's really important, especially just being in New York. Everything had to have like an end. Like everything was like a means to an end. You can't just like fucking do a doodle. Like the doodle has to get likes. Like just make something. Just like fart around. Just have fun. And be honest. That's really it. Like, and maybe with the thing you said about like passively or not passively, like the Capricorn Aquarius thing, where you said the Aquarius is like about the collective, it cares about the collective. I care about the collective.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's why I'm trying to move to a socialist country. Because I'm so sick
which is why I guess Aquarius.
I'm so sick of individualism. Like, it's so boring as well, just to like think about yourself, just to be up your own fucking ass all the time. Like, get out there, man. Interact. Try to make some friends. Put in some effort. Make some plans. Reach out.
Did you say fart around?
Yeah, fart around.
I like it.
I put you put artist
in your bio.
In my Instagram bio.
That's when I was like, oh, I'm going to reach out. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, this
are farts funny? The eternal question.
I hate farts.
No, farts are funny. I disagree.
Do you hate your own farts? You do?
Yeah, I do. It's just like a pet peeve. Yeah.
I mean, I don't love it, but I, you know, just the sound of the word.
It's a natural. It's a natural part of life.
Yeah. You got to be free to fart.
Yeah, freedom. Freedom is farting, right?
Yeah.
Farting is freedom. Okay. So this is great. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is the end of our episode, Bondus. We hope you enjoyed this, and thank you so much for joining us on this journey. If you'd like to reach out to us, we can be found on Instagram and Facebook at The Desi Condition and on Twitter at TDCPodcast_. You can also email us at thedesicondition@gmail.com or visit our two websites, tdcpodcast.com and, of course, our Desi Creatives directory at desicollaborative.co. Stay safe, stay warm, make good choices, and we'll talk to you next time.